snob zones. If you're out, you'll stay out.
Because they've continually upzoned, you know, the people who can live there are pretty much wealthy people.
Communities that fight back change and the price they pay. Plus, the new face of Midwest businesses and the woman who battled for workplace safety after a deadly factory fire. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. Summer's coming, and many of us will spend weekends visiting places we can never afford to live. The author of a new book, Snob Zones: Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate, profiles a handful of New England towns to examine how they've managed to stay exclusive. But New York Times reporter Lisa Prevost found that by staying exclusive, they're paying a price that endangers their town's future. Lisa, your book Snob Zones focuses on New England, but let's make it plain, this could probably apply to just about any place in the country, right?
You could probably write the same type of book around any major metropolitan area, I would say. Say D.C., anywhere out in California, not so much the South. They just put up gates there. Any of the major areas, it's an issue. I know especially D.C. and California.
And what you're talking about are towns that are trying to preserve their character, but they do it in such a way that only the wealthy end up being able to live there. I particularly enjoyed the story about Roxbury, Connecticut, where the person who proposed 4-acre or larger zoning for new homes only had 3 acres on his own property.
Yeah, a little under four, somewhere between 3 and 4. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, not so common when people move in and then they don't want anywhere else to move in. It was the reason I wrote the book, because it became so curious to me that you would have, when I would cover zoning hearings for the New York Times, you would have people on the one hand complaining that their kids can't come back and live in the town, and then on the other, when they would be faced with a project that might allow their kids to come back, you know, absolutely not, we don't want that here, that's not what our town is about. And it didn't matter how many different pieces of information you could put in front of them to dispel whatever their fears were. Usually it was going to fill our schools with kids and we can't afford that, it's going to bring crime to the area, it's going to bring people who are all getting public assistance, and we don't want that here. And if you would put, you know, line up all this information and say, that's not true, that's not true, that's not true, it didn't matter. It's a complete blind spot for a lot of people.
And we're not talking about gated communities. We're not talking about communities with signs saying, keep out. What other things besides zoning regulations are being used to keep people out?
Yeah, that's a good point. And you know, that when I say the book is called Snob Zones, but it's not really just about zoning. I mean, a snob zone, when I refer to a snob zone, I'm talking as much about attitudes as I am about a place. And yes, you can use large lot zoning to turn away higher density development. But there are also other very effective ways to turn that kind of development away. You can, if you have the means, you can keep a developer tied up in court for so long that, you know, he finally goes away. That's called death by delay. You can kill the project that way. You can use political maneuvering if you have the right connections. You can change the rules midstream, which Roxbury did in years past to turn away a commercial development, just simply changed the zoning. And the developer went to court and said, you know, they can't pull the rug out on me for I've already applied. And they had, the zoning was in place, and the judge said, well, no, they can't. But by that time, the economy had turned, and the developer could no longer build. And then you can just, you know, even like the town of Darien, you can appear to be doing something that will open access, but still add provisions that limit access. They adopted what's called inclusionary zoning, which simply means that if a developer comes in, proposes you know, a subdivision or an apartment building, they have to set aside some portion of those housing units for below market rate affordable housing. But in Darien's case, they added language in that provision that said those affordable housing units will only be available first to people who live or work in Darien already or used to live here and want to come back. So if you were someone outside of Darien who wanted to apply for one of those units, you would be at the back of a very long, long line.
Lisa, from what you saw, what happens to the communities that are successful in turning back change?
Well, I mean, let's talk about Roxbury, the town in Litchfield County that I write about. Was a farm community, gradually became a destination for wealthy New Yorkers, beginning with Arthur Miller. And over time, you know, those people had the money to help set aside land, which made the town all the more attractive. And, of course, if you already lived there, it was great. You know, you had these people setting aside land for you, and your town wasn't changing. But now, because they've continually upzoned so that now you need a minimum of 4 acres to build a house almost everywhere in town, you know, the people who can live there are pretty much wealthy people. And so what's happened is that Roxbury is now one of the oldest towns in Connecticut by median age, and they constantly are in a scramble to get enough volunteers to round out their firefighting force and to staff all the town committees. And in fact, you'll see great overlap between different committees, same people serving on two or three committees. And also their school enrollment is projected to plummet over the next decade because they don't have the young families. So they're going to be paying a lot of money for their elementary school with fewer kids.
Lisa, let's also talk about Watch Hill, Rhode Island, which you discussed in your book. It is one of my favorite beaches on the East Coast, but there is very, very limited public parking to access that beach, and it seems like there's less parking every year.
Yeah, that's kind of a insidious trend, and one that I think people don't notice so much because, you know, you just sort of, you go to your same beaches and you, maybe you can't find a place to park and you think, well, you know, these beaches are getting too crowded. But what's happening is that really there's less and less access for the same reasons, really, that people move to a shore town, buy expensive property. They don't want, you know, someone encroaching on their privacy, understandably, but there are rules about the waterfront being open to the public, you know, up to a certain point on the beach, which is also a issue of debate where that point is. But it's kind of a slow process where, you know, access is gradually being denied and people are being kind of restricted to smaller and smaller portions of the shore.
So are we looking at a future where there are simply communities that most people will not have access to and the rest of us will be confined to other areas?
Well, I would say we're already there in many parts of the Northeast. I mean, we have great concentrated poverty in our cities in Connecticut and great affluence in the suburbs surrounding those cities. We have great disparities in educational achievement between the cities and the suburbs, and great disparities in income. So are we headed there? I think we're already there, you know, only in a lot of places. And you could say the same about parts of Massachusetts. Now, there are some trends that could help turn this around a little bit, one being that we have the baby boomers now going into retirement, and some portion of them will want to downsize, so they'll be looking for smaller housing types. And we also have the millennials coming up who have been shown in various surveys that they really don't want the big house on the big tract of land. They are more interested in walkable living close to town. So that would necessitate smaller types of housing. And then there's also the trends in energy prices, which makes it more expensive to heat houses, more expensive to drive a long ways. So all of these things together, should the market allow it, will kind of drive up demand for these smaller housing types.
Lisa Prevost is the author of Snob Zones, Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate. Coming up, more us versus them, this time over light rail in California. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1246. If you think of LA, you probably think of bumper-to-bumper traffic. But there's a project underway to address the issue. The Exposition Light Rail Line from downtown Los Angeles is under construction, and transit planners are hoping to extend the line from Culver City to Santa Monica. David Cates reports on the legal battle against two proposed routes near one West LA neighborhood.
Listening to some Cheviot Hills area residents, you'd think their neighborhood's being invaded by angry militia.
It's the death of a neighborhood.
And all it's going to do is facilitate the inner city to basically this part of the city.
It's not going to be policed.
The light rail line being considered would follow the old Exposition Boulevard train track bordering Cheviot Hills. It lies between Century City and the 10 Freeway. But many homeowners in the community want the line routed a mile and a half to the south on Venice and Sepulveda, where there are busy commercial streets. They say their neighborhood is too residential.
It's a very quiet, nice, clean neighborhood.
I live on the corner here, and I have people now dropping the trash off right here next to my house, right on Overland. There's no respect. People graffiti my wall all the time. That's just, it's going to get worse.
Flory Parks actually supports light rail.
I just don't want it 2 blocks from my house. If it was a mile from my house, I'd be thrilled.
Is this a classic case of not in my backyard or NIMBYism? Light Rail for Cheviot Hills founder and resident Karen Leonard says yes.
They really don't want it here. And they have all kinds of prejudices and fears, and I think largely unfounded.
Friends for Expo Transit co-chair Daryl Clark agrees.
We think it's premature to be saying it's horrible, put it somewhere else, when the project alternatives aren't even defined yet and the impacts really aren't documented.
However, Kevin Hughes says residents should bring up concerns about their own neighborhood. He's president of the Cheviot Hills Homeowners Association.
There is something wrong with classism, and there's something wrong with racism, and environmental justice is a serious issue. But everyone should care about their backyards, and everyone should be invested, and everybody should want safety.
Many residents worry about putting a station next to the Overland Avenue Elementary School, one of the best in the area. Light rail wheels can squeal when they go around a curve, and the trains vibrate the ground. But residents are open to compromise. Kevin Hughes supports the Expo line below ground as it passes Cheviot Hills. Putting the rail in a trench would address worries about car traffic on Overland Boulevard, safety, and noise. Also, transit officials would propose a bike path and landscaping parallel to the rail. Resident Flory Parks likes the idea.
If they made a nice, you know, long, beautiful park like other cities like Portland and Seattle have, that'd be fantastic, and that would increase property values.
Friends for Expo Transit's Gerald Clark believes the train actually could be a boon for Cheviot Hills.
It would have an exclusivity as an upscale neighborhood on the west side with good transit access as an alternative to being absolutely horribly jammed in traffic on the Santa Monica Freeway.
I hope the line to Santa Monica will open in 2015. David Cates, Enberg Radio News.
The cities of America's industrial heartland were built by immigrants. Cities like Detroit, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh are hoping another wave of immigrants will help reinvigorate the economy. Chicago-based reporter Nyla Boudou reports for the public media project Changing Gears.
On Chicago's southwest side, the 26th Street corridor in Little Village is hopping. It's Saturday morning, and the streets are full of families, wheeling carts and kids in strollers as they shop. I'm standing outside the Little Village Chamber of Commerce with its new director, Nilda Esparza, and its vice chair, Robert Garza. They're talking about how this area is a cultural and economic home to the city's Mexican population.
On the strip here, you'll find somewhere about, I would say, 550 to 600 businesses.
From grocery stores, travel agencies, everything you can find here on 26th Street.
Garza's family came here from Mexico in the 1940s. They opened one of the first grocery stores in Little Village. Now, the area is a bustling center of city commerce and home to the largest concentration of Mexican Americans in the Midwest.
Now, Little Village is a place where a lot of us have started and a lot of us have flourished.
Jesus Davila is standing outside Davila's restaurant, just one of his four businesses. He says his two restaurants alone make at least $1.5 million in revenue a year. He also has another business that makes small parts and a photo studio. But they don't just do photos there.
Here we do income taxes. We assist people on doing the immigration forms.
300 miles to the east, when Steve Tabachman looks at neighborhoods like Chicago's Little Village, he's not just envious. He's trying to figure out how it can be replicated in southeast Michigan.
Well, I think immigrants represent a tremendous potential. Already the role that they're playing, for example, here in southeast Michigan, is that they are critical components of the energy that's driving us to the new economies.
Tabachman is in charge of the Global Detroit Initiative. He's working with Pittsburgh and Cleveland to try to make all of their cities more welcoming to immigrants. He points to Hispanic and Arab communities that are repopulating parts of Detroit, creating rare economic bright spots. Tabachman also likes to reel off figures like this one. In Michigan, almost 40% of the tech businesses started in the past decade were created by immigrants. This from a state where just 5% of its population was born outside the country. One way Detroit is working with Cleveland and Pittsburgh is to create a regional center for a government visa program called the EB-5. That's where would-be immigrants who are willing to invest $1 million and create 10 American jobs qualify for a green card for them and their families. Back in Chicago, a group of 36 university computer science students are handing in a coding test.
Please bring your test forward or email your results to careers.
It's an effort by the Illinois Technology Association to ensure that the next generation of entrepreneurs stays in the Midwest. For the first time this year, the tech group visited 7 universities throughout Illinois. They fed computer students lots of pizza and gave them the first round of tests. The top 45 made it to Chicago, where they've sat for this 2-hour exam. The winner will get $5,000. More importantly, there are recruiters from a dozen or so Illinois-based tech companies waiting outside the room to meet and interview the test takers. Most of the room is full of international students from China and India, but also Eastern Europe. Vivek Tyagarajan is a senior at the University of Illinois. He's 22. He says there are tons of reasons why he wants to stay here instead of going home to India.
The corporate culture here, the lifestyle, money.
He points out he's not in a position to bargain for where he wants to go. He needs to go where the jobs are because his employer will sponsor him. But all things being equal...
Yeah, I'd love to stay here.
For Changing Gears, I'm Nyla Boodoo in Chicago.
Finally, Gilles Malkin is back with a profile of a woman who saw a nightmare and dedicated her life to keeping people safer on the job.
Frances Perkins was not a celebrity by any means. She did not want to be one. She was proper, private, Bostonian. But never has a bureaucrat worked so hard, so tirelessly, and so effectively for the benefit of the American worker. And it's completely wrong that we shouldn't know about a person to whom today's working American owes their well-being, to say nothing of someone who set such a sterling example of how a dedicated, determined woman can shatter old boundaries for the participation of women in taking the most important decisions for our country. Frances Perkins was born Fanny Coralie Perkins in Boston in 1880. It was no easy task for her to obtain a Bachelor of Arts or a Master's degree, but she did both, the first at Mount Holyoke, the second at Columbia. In the teens and 20s of the century, she accumulated wide experience in public service, working for a time at Hull House in Chicago under Jane Addams, working to help immigrant girls in Philadelphia, then doing social work in New York City. Due to the advent of industry and the abuses perpetrated upon the common worker, the turn of the century was a time ripe for social reform, and Perkins made that her life's purpose. By 1911, Perkins, who was already executive secretary of the New York Consumers League and rubbing shoulders with the likes of Al Smith and Robert Wagner, witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York City. The workers, mostly women, were worked long hours and 6 days a week. The building had no fire alarm, no fire extinguishers, and only a flimsy fire escape in lieu of a protected fire stair that soon collapsed under the weight of those who managed to crawl out onto it. 146 women and children perished due to locked doors and exits, a method by which the management sought to prevent theft and to keep out union organizers. She watched some of the women stop to pray on the window ledges before leaping to their deaths. The experience appalled Perkins, who was in the position to know that this was not an isolated incident, but it ignited her inspiration to dedicate her life to the cause of the safety and welfare of ordinary workers. She was subsequently appointed by Al Smith as head of the Committee on Public Safety, a commission formed to look into the disaster and to formulate new laws to prevent recurrences. And her tenacity prompted Smith to later seat her on the New York State Industrial Commission. There she inspected workplaces and fought hard to eliminate the dangers for workers and other abuses that were being practiced by employers, and she managed to reduce women's work week to 54 hours. But due to their deep pockets and the latitude of our justice system toward such, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory's owners were acquitted. In 1929, Frances Perkins was appointed industrial commissioner by the newly elected New York State governor, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And in 1933, when he took the office of president, he brought her into the White House as secretary of the Department of Labor. Frances Perkins was thus the first woman ever to head a presidential executive department and the first woman ever to hold a cabinet position, making her the first to hold an office that was in direct line of succession to the presidency itself. Since it had been revealed time and again that the capitalist system cannot prevent or protect workers against its own frequent economic downturns, Perkins reasoned a system had to be enacted that would protect the workers in those hard times. Social Security was conceived as the buffer for those inevitable and recurrent low spots. She wanted to create a safety net, unemployment insurance with federal participation, federal laws prohibiting child labor, a 40-hour work week, workers' compensation for injuries on the job, a minimum wage, a working public employment system, and national health insurance. It had never been considered as part of government to assist dependent and disabled children, unemployables, or the blind. FDR promised to back her up, and he did. One can't help but notice how strikingly the workers' situation in American industry today is echoing the strife of those days so long ago. It seems like the cycle of oppression has started again, only on a much larger scale. Mega corporations have turned to cheaper labor in other countries, and neglect leading to industrial accidents has recently cost the lives of scores of workers, albeit some of those workshops are on the far side of the globe. And although many of these corporations have so much money they can't even count it, Congress keeps passing bills that cater to their greed. The leaders we empower need to be reminded that, as Perkins said, it's morally unacceptable to accept poverty in the midst of plenty in a society that claims to be Christian and democratic. After 12 years as Secretary of Labor, Frances Perkins served on the U.S. Civil Service Commission under Truman from 1945 to 1952. She then retired and lectured at Cornell well into her 80s and died in 1965. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, actor, and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.